There's going to be a work session on Senate Bill 5612 and Senate Bill 5613, the thief bill for the Department of Forestry. Susie, I think we'll do 5612 first. Is that okay?
Sure.
That's okay. We'll do it the other way around. Doesn't matter to me.
It does matter to me either.
Are you ready for 13? We'll do the fee bill first.
I don't care. It's up to you. Your pleasure.
This is the Department of Forestry first, then.
All right, then.
Okay. Open a work session for Senate Bill 5612, Department of Forestry, and LFO will lead us through this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You have the work session papers at your places. The first page is a summary of the governor's recommended budget and a chart giving a historical view of expenditures compared to the LFO recommended budget. So I'm going to move on from there to the technical adjustments. The first page of the work session shows technical adjustments for reductions in the attorney general rate, PERS rate, death assessment reduction, and a vacancy savings adjustment. Do you want to go through all of the packages or just do technical motion?
I'd like to go through the whole thing as one motion and have discussions to go along with any of the committee members that want to.
Okay.
My guess is there will be a comment from my left concerning B here.
The Attorney General.
Oh, I'm sorry.
109 to 98. Is that a misprint?
It is. It's 111 to 109. I'm sorry. That is misprint. Right here, Attorney General rate was reduced from 111 to 109.
I thought it was 119 to 111. Is this something new that's happened? It was 119 to 111. I'm hollering about that.
Well, I'll verify it, but I believe it's 111 to 109.
Okay.
Your number sounds right, though.
It's 119 to 111, yeah. Because, Susie, the only reason I know that is because I'm hollering about it every
year. Yeah.
All right, then.
He's got me wired on it now, too. And your point, it has to do with this is actually not a total reduction. It's a reduction of an increase. Would that be a point by any chance?
That's a typical what we're doing.
It's only
a 12% reduction of an increase. A 12% increase of reduction.
Of a couple of percentage points.
That's
gotcha.
All
okay.
Right.
Point well taken, though.
Yes, indeed. These are the technical adjustments. And I would just point out to you that these adjustments are the same as the House budget.
Thank you. We'll go right to the policy packages for us.
Yes. The first package has five components. It's a package that's the result of a review of positions to determine which positions in the agency could be combined by adding months or eliminating or reducing the number of unnecessary positions and full-time equivalents in the budget. This is in response to a budget note that the legislature put in their budget last session. We're recommending approval of the package. It's also a package that's been approved in the House budget plan. So that would take you to page 2. Package 090 eliminated the industrial fire program in the governor's budget. We're recommending approval of the reduction with a technical adjustment to eliminate the revenue component of $1.7 million other funds.
Was this in parallel with the House this morning?
Yes. No. House plan restores the industrial fire program.
So that's why I brought it up.
And we move right to here. Okay. Package 204.
Page 4 of 10.
Okay. Just different program areas. Package 211 is a national fire plan. This is federal funds supporting community fire plans and ensuring federal and state rules are supported. This is we're recommending approval in the amount of $3,494,713. That's reduced as a result of the PERS rate reduction. This is the same in the House. House plan is the same as the Senate plan on this package. 802A reduces severity funding in the base budget and shifts it to the emergency fund reservation. We're recommending approval of the reduction, which is the same as in the House. But the second part of the component is to create a special purpose appropriation to the emergency board for fire suppression and catastrophic fire insurance premium. The Senate plan is not approving this package because there are questions remain regarding the amounts of public funds that should share in the protection from fire program. The House plan approved the special purpose appropriation. Package 231 is the force management plan, adding 23 positions. The agency requested an adjustment of two of those positions. We're recommending approving the positions as limited duration, not permanent, as the agency requests, in the amount of $2,385,582. That takes into account the adjustment for the reduction of the two positions and HERS rate adjustment for a total number of 21.98 FTE in the budget. If the agency can show that the harvest levels will be sustained at the current levels of 250 million board feet or more, the positions could be made permanent by the emergency board during the interim. This package was approved this morning in the House subcommittee as well.
Good, thank you.
Package 232 is a Tillamook Forest Center operations. Provides staff for the operation of the Tillamook Forest Center, scheduled to open this fall. The agency requested reducing the package by three positions. We're recommending approving their reduction in positions for a total budget of $697,489, and not approving the transfer from the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department for their lottery monies, requiring the department to use their state forest receipts to fund the entire package. The House plan approved the package with the use of the lottery funds from the State Parks Department.
We all understand the difference there. We're going to come back to just for a moment on the other package of the fire protection plan. We'll talk about that in a minute. But you understand the difference here? Okay. That's stuff we talked about in the committee before. Good.
Package 233 is a reduction in services and supplies for management of the Common School Lands Fund reduction. It takes the agency to their current services level of services and supplies. This was approved this morning by the House subcommittee, and we're recommending approval in the Senate plan. Package 90 restores... In the governor's budget, it restored $2.1 million utilizing federal Pacific Coastal Salmon recovery funds for Forestry Department's share of Oregon plan, of managing the Oregon plan. We're reversing that shift of general fund to PCSRF other funds back to using general funds. And then the federal monies will be used in other natural resource programs in lieu of general funds, so that this agency doesn't have to deal with trying to figure out whether or not they comply with the requirements for using those federal funds. This is the same as the House plan.
Just so we remind ourselves and let the audience know, this is something we're going to see all through these budgets. It's a consensus plan. And we do have an indication from the federal government that they are comfortable with this, and we expect a written memo from them soon, which will confirm that, so we won't be having to have that battle. This is something we've all agreed to and should go through our budget without any question. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's fine. Package 252 is a federal watershed grant that would increase the forest stewardship capacities. This is not recommended because the package relies on federal funds that are not yet available. And when the funding becomes available, a grant can be requested from the emergency board, and they can request their expenditure limitation at that time. This is the same as the House plan approved this morning. Package 254 has another fund and federal funds component. This is a smoke management fee. This is the subject of the other bill that you will be hearing later this morning. This is the expenditure component of that. It is $187,538 reduced for the PERS rate, and the federal fund component are the direct payments from the federal land management agencies, U.S. Forest Services, and BLM. The House also adopted this morning. Package 255 is the reforestation tax credit. To maintain the department's ability to continue to administer the reforestation tax credit program. Previously, this was financed with the Western Oregon Timber Tax, which sunsets in a couple weeks, and the agency is requesting that general funds be restored to maintain this program. We're recommending that this be approved, but that the harvest tax receipts pay the entire amount of this program. The House plan approved this morning using the general fund, not relying on harvest tax receipts. Package 258 is the Cooperative Forestry Assistance that establishes an expenditure limitation to allow the agency to accept money for services that they provide under a cooperative agreement. And we're recommending approval, and this was approved by the House subcommittee this morning. The next package is a Senate plan program reduction to eliminate the Oregon Plan Landowner Technical Assistance and reduce forest practices, regulatory actions, and enforcement. It reduces the program by $875,948 general fund and $571,836 other fund. The House approach to program reduction was to take a 3% services and supplies and capital outlay reduction across all programs that had general fund in it. The Senate plan targets the program in private community forests.
So the House not concur with the Senate plan?
Correct.
Okay.
Package H-12 is the Forest Legacy Program. It's to establish a pilot Forest Legacy Program in Oregon to protect private forest land from being converted to non-forest uses by providing federal funding for acquiring the development rights to the threatened private forest land through conservation easement or fee title. We're adding $2,021,000 federal fund limitation to the agency's budget and recommending that this be approved with the understanding that the department will apply for the federal grants and, if awarded, accept the federal grant from the United States Department of Agriculture Forest Service to update the assessment of need and to establish pilot projects.
Senator Shields, do you want to comment on this? If you don't, I will.
I'll let you make the comments rather than me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The Forest Legacy Program is a federally funded program, and it basically has two components as far as we're concerned. The first component is getting a good assessment done of what the needs of the state might or are. That's a fairly small amount of money, I think about $21,000 if I remember right. The second part of it is what do you put in that assessment and what do you use the money on? And the federal law is fairly clear that it is both for sustainable forest practices in certain land you would pick that are actually harvestable, and it's also for other uses besides that, so that it has a chance to be used for lands usually near cities which can be conserved. There is a debate going on about those two issues, and that's why we've included it as a policy package. There are those who feel it should not be something the state of Oregon should be taking part in, others who feel we should. Other states have taken part in this. Washington and some other western states have used this money extensively to prevent development of forest lands and development of some lands which would not necessarily be considered high production forest lands, also to preserve those lands. So it's a debate we'll have as we go along. Yes, Senator Shields.
I'd just like to add two numbers to this thing. The state of Washington has received $16 million in forest legacy funds while we've not done so. Second point, we had received in 2003 $1.1 million from the Bush administration, which we sent back to Washington. We patted ourselves on the back for being good stewards. Washington, D.C. sent our $1.1 million to New Mexico for forest legacy. What kind of sense does that make?
Well, I'm not going to argue the case because I'm on your side, and you may feel differently. But we're trying to prevent significant lands from being just thrown back into development. And with the present debate going on in the state about ballot measure 37 and all the other issues involved, this is an important program in which I think we should take part in. How much we take part in and where those lands are needs to be assessed, and that's the least we should be doing.
I would only say, Mr. Chair, is that there's 30 million out of about the 65 million acres in the state of Oregon are now forest lands already.
Unfortunately, the vast majority of that is federal forests, yeah, and we can't touch those. And you and I have had that conversation before. I'd also point out that the feds are selling off some land this year, much greater than anything we're purchasing. So it goes both ways. The other things I'd like to take a moment and talk about is the other big piece of this budget we're going to have to negotiate yet, and I'm very sad we're doing it this way. I'm not happy that we have split ways and means, is the fire protection plan. That plan basically evolved around how much public money goes into the program and how much private money goes into the program and how that money is shifted. It's a very complex plan that has been proposed. There's not buy-off on all sides of it, and that's going to be debated over the next week or two, I expect, before we come to some form of resolution. And it affects other budgets other than natural resources, because it's all part of that milieu of differences we have between the House and the Senate. So we're laying this out now. We'll take it to the Senate Special Committee, but clearly, obviously, this is not necessarily the final budget. I think we're all aware of that. I want to kind of get that on the record as we go through. Do you want to continue now? I think we probably should take a vote on this section that we're to right now, if we could. I would entertain a motion concerning the technical adjustments as well as the LFO recommended policy packages for Senate Bill 5612.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
It has been moved, and I will now ask for a vote. Voice vote on this, because I think we have to consider all people involved in this committee with the complete politeness.
Senator Nelson?
I'm voting no.
Senator Schultz?
Aye.
Aye. The motion passes. We'll move on to budget notes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first budget note had to do with the emergency board appropriation that is not being adopted by the Senate plan and therefore will not be approved by this subcommittee, but I wanted to share with you the budget note that was adopted that would have gone with that package had we decided to approve it. The second budget note has to do with timber harvest levels. This is the same budget note that was approved by in the House plan, and we are recommending it. The budget note says that in recognition of the short and long-term concerns of the counties and the legislature about harvest levels on state forests, and in conjunction with the State Land Board, the Department of Forestry will make every effort to produce annual operation plans that produce harvest volumes that sustain current volumes for the Elliott, Clatsop, and Tillamook State Forests. Department of Forestry is directed to continue to work with county commissioners, county representatives, legislators, and the Legislative Fiscal Office on creating a harvesting model that explores options to determine optimal timber and harvest outputs. The work group will provide a report to the Emergency Board every 6 months on the outcomes of the harvesting modeling project. The third budget note has to do with the National Fire Plan. The National Fire Plan states its purpose is to provide technical, financial, and resource guidance and support for wildland fire management. National resources are made available to respond to severe wildland fires and their impacts to communities while ensuring sufficient firefighting capacity for the future. Recognizing that preparation for severe fire seasons is a critical issue, the department is directed to seek federal grants to be used for increased initial attack capabilities such as helicopter services, heavy equipment, engine crews, and fireline hand crews. The department is further directed to seek federal grants to aid in the implementation of state laws relating to the urban-rural interface solutions to reduce the risks of fire. The department is directed to work with the insurance industry to identify hazardous areas in the urban-rural interface and results of providing assistance to reduce risks. The department is expected to provide a report to the Emergency Board by December 2005 on the availability of federal grants, and by November 2006 on the efforts to engage the insurance industry in reducing risks to the urban-rural interface. This was approved by the House.
Also. Thank you. I entertain a motion on the budget notes to not approve A, but to approve B and C as printed.
Is that all one motion?
That is one motion.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm glad to make that a motion. You are aware that I have some questions about timber sales at some point in time that I want to ask.
Well, we have a motion on the floor, and that was a good time to discuss it.
Well, this is something that we've talked about with Marvin already, and I just kind of want to get it on the record. We showed him very quickly, where are you? There you are, some timber sales and you saw a sheet that we showed you.
We have the agency head. Can we step up here, please?
Also, Representative Witt is in the audience, and he was on the Board of Forestry, and maybe he has some questions, too. So if you wouldn't mind,
would you like to come forward also?
I'd like to ask him to come. I'm just wanting to get into the record how timber sales occur and the pricing thereof. And I'm looking at a timber sale status and auction schedule, and I see, and I've had people that know an awful lot more than I do about this try at least to explain it to me. Can you give us some general comments, Marvin, on the difference in the bids and why, what the factors are for the wide range of diversity? We're looking here at a sheet with Tillamook, Clatsop, and Clackamas, and Coos Douglas forests.
Certainly. For the record, I'm Marvin Brown, Director of the Department of Forestry. And Chair Bates, Senator Shields, yeah, we talked about a little bit, and there's a lot of reasons why you get variable bids on any given timber sale. I think one of the things that you had showed me was some fairly distinct differences between the Tillamook, the Clatsop, and the Elliott. And just in the most general sense, the Tillamook has the smallest trees. Clatsop has the next largest trees on average, and Elliott has the largest trees, certainly of the three.
Why is that, since Tillamook and Clatsop, if I'm not wrong, aren't they about the same since they had the fire? Or?
Senator Bates and Senator Shields, there's more of the Clatsop that wasn't involved in the Tillamook fire. I'm not speaking wrong there, I don't believe. It's more of that was actually not burned during the Tillamook fires, and so it has some older trees on it.
Okay.
There's lots of other reasons.
Okay.
In addition to those, they include, the overall price of wood products, and whether that's on an upward trend or downward trend, and whether any particular company competing in that market has a good inventory of logs or a bad inventory of logs. It depends on the logging costs associated with any given site. If logging costs are going to be high, folks are going to bid less on the stumpage. It depends on transportation costs. The further a company is away from a particular site that's to be harvested, the less they're going to bid relative to the fact that they're going to spend more hauling those logs back to the mill. Those are all things that build into the factors. What we do when we advertise that is try to come up with our best estimate of what current, what we call pond values are, which are the values that are paid at the mill, and use that as kind of our guide for minimal acceptable bids, and then see what we get from there. And we usually get a pretty wide variation on bids.
Yeah, I've noticed that wide variation in some of the stuff that I've been
looking at. Sure. We had during the time I've looked at those bids in the last 2 years, we've had Douglas fir on the Tillamook sell for $230-something a thousand and $860-something a thousand on the Elliott. So there's that kind of variation that exists out there.
And you can understand why somebody would look at that just kind of off the cuff and say, why that huge diversity? And it has to do with...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, Chair and Senator, it has to do with the fact that there's just a huge number of variables that relate to what any individual company is going to bid on any individual sale.
Thank you.
Brad, or Representative Witt, sorry, I've known you for so many years, I tend to use your first name. You were on the Board of Forestry. You've got to know more than I do about this subject. Do you want to make a few comments or raise a few concerns?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, Brad Witt, State Representative from House District 31. Just by way of background, I was contacted by representatives of several different labor unions who had looked at some of the the sales that were posted apparently on the internet from the department's data, and were concerned enough that they had come to me and asked if I had any idea, living close to the Clatsop Forest, why timber from that forest it was selling in the neighborhood of $100 per thousand board feet more than sales off of the Tillamook. And I frankly said, no, I really cannot account for that. And at that point was shown, I'm presuming, the same data that you have there. And it was enough sales on that sheet that it face value, I think, causes pause and begs the question why. I have since been approached by some environmental organizations asking the same question. And I don't know. I can't account for it. Given the nature of a public resource, I think that it warrants maybe sitting down with maybe State Forester Brown's staff and going through some of these sales and just determining what the cause is for the disparity between the prices on those sales. And I agree completely with everything Forester Brown has said, that there are many different reasons that could cause this, but unless you take a look at sale by sale, it's hard to know what the causes or reasons for that are. So,
thank you. I'm going to close this discussion. We've got to move on. Mr. Brown, possibly you get those people together, have a discussion of it, and get back to us at a later time.
I'd be happy to, Senator.
We'll be here for another 2 or 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, or 6 weeks. We'll be here for weeks. Okay. I'd like to hear a conclusion of that discussion if you could at a later time. Okay. We have to move forward today.
Yeah,
thank you.
Very quickly, I just want to thank you both. I did find it very helpful to have somebody kind of translate the timber sale status and auction schedule into English, because I couldn't understand it. And maybe some of that will be helpful with some of the other communities that have raised concerns with us, particularly the minimum bid stuff that I didn't understand before. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
All right, we have a motion before us to not pass the budget note A, but to pass the budget notes B and C.
I think I said so moved.
You did.
Okay.
Do we need to take a vote on this?
I'll be a no vote. You can just put me down as a no vote.
No vote. Perfect. Record Senator Nelson's no vote and Senators Shields and Bates' yes votes. Budget notes then are approved as stated, with one disapproval.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, before we leave the budget notes, I just want to point out that along with budget note A, the agency presented a report to the House Budget Committee this morning relating to their severity plan for the 2005 fire season, and it was acknowledged, they acknowledged receipt of that report. We will not be acknowledging receipt of that report, which will put the agency in a position of not, of either establishing contracts that are subject to legislative approval at a later date or not entering into those contracts.
I would state again that we need to close this process down. And it's a bad process to have ways and means split. We'll try to resolve the differences in this budget as quickly as possible so the agency can go forward with those contracts. We don't want to put the state in jeopardy for July, August, September, and October for fire protection because we can't agree in this building. We'll work on that very quickly. Okay?
Then with that, Mr. Chair, what we do is I recommend approving the budget bill in the amount of $231,817,563, 899.63 FTE, by inserting the language from the original budget bill, House Bill 5030, into Senate Bill 5612 with the dollar amounts indicated in your memorandum.
I would ask we not read through that. Thank you.
I
would entertain a motion as stated.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
To amend Senate Bill 5612.
Show me as a no vote.
I'll assume Senator Nelson will be a no vote, or is a no vote. Senator Shields and Senator Bates are yes votes. The motion is approved. Motion now for 612 to full committee with the due pass recommendation.
So moved.
Any objections? Okay. Senator Nelson will be a no vote. Senator Shields and Bates will be a yes vote. And the motion is passed. Move Senate Bill 612 to a full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Mr. Chair, the last item of business with this budget has to do with their performance measures. The agency worked very hard on updating and improving their measures during their public hearing phases. They have reworked several of their measures. There are, I think, three that we've asked them to do a little bit more modification on. Measure number 11, we asked them to expand the measure to define the total land base and percent of the total field that has been inspected. This is relating to the percent of inspected commercial forest operations. The new measure must be approved by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee by October 1st, 2006. In measure number 14, relating to the percent of wildland fires, 10 acres or less, we asked them to evaluate the target. All years show that the target was exceeded in all but 1 year, and we'd like to have the targets approved by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee by October 1st, 2006. And then added lost time days per 1,000 fire line exposure hours, and then added the two customer service measures that are being added to all agency budgets.
I read through these again last night, and frankly had to review them in my mind. It's been long since I saw them the first time. They seemed appropriate to me. I'm not an expert in forestry. Do you have any objections? Senator Shields, any objections?
No, I was just going to say I don't think you're barking up the wrong tree there. Sorry.
Moving. I would entertain a motion to accept the performance measures. Whether we're barking up the wrong tree or not, Senator Shield.
So moved.
We have a yes vote from Senator Nelson. Something like pulling teeth here this morning. And a yes vote
because
from
it's afternoon.
Yeah, oh, it's afternoon. And a yes vote from Bates. And if you hear no other objections, we'll accept the performance measures as stated. I believe that completes our work for the Department of Forestry. Is that correct?
That bill, yes.
Now we have the fee bill. So I will close the work session on 612.
And we'll move. Carrier.
I'll be the carrier. Sorry, I have to be the carrier.
He's the only carrier.
The gentleman to my left would start voting yes, Lamora. I give him an opportunity to carry some bills. Now move to the fee bill for 613. I'll open a work session on the fee bill for Senate Bill 613 for the Department of Forestry. Can you lead us to this also, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The fee bill is a. I don't remember if I gave you copies of the amendment. Is a ratification of the fee that the agency adopted during the interim. They increased the pile burn fee from $2 to $5, increasing it by $3. They expect to generate $189,000 with this fee increase. This fee increase was required as a result of a reduction in general funds to the agency, and the agency had been instructed by the last legislature to increase the fee to make up that difference, and this just ratifies that so they can continue their program.
I would assume that the House passed a similar bill this morning.
Yes, they did.
Okay. I entertain a motion for Senate Bill 613.
So moved. Do you want this amendment first? Separately?
Let's pass. You're correct, Senator Shields. Let's pass the amendments first. Proposed amendments to Senate Bill 5613.
So moved.
There are no objections, so ordered. And then I will now entertain a motion for Senate Bill 5613 as amended.
I would move.
My God, they move himself. It has been moved that Senate Bill 613 be reported to the Special Committee on Budget. Hearing no objection, so moved. Carrier. Now we complete. Carrier will be Senator Nelson.
Fee bill, this is.
I know it goes against your grain, I know, but it's good for you.
You're asking for a pun about grain. Related, going against the grain.
I didn't mean it that way.
Don't want to do that.
Slip of the tongue, okay?
Okay.
That completes our work for the forest. We'll report to the department, and this session is closed. We're going to immediately move to public hearing on Senate Bill 532. We have to be in a different committee at 3 o'clock. You're on the full budget. Frank, you're not. You have to be somewhere else at 3 o'clock, too.
Yeah, I think of plenty of places to go. That means we've got an hour and 20 minutes to do this.
Yes. This is a sensitive bill for many reasons. Let me open up first. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 532. This is a sensitive bill for many reasons, not the least of which that...
Yeah, it must be. Everybody's leaving.
Yes. Others will be coming in, I'm sure. Many people felt that in the closing moments of a committee not to be named, that they did not have an opportunity to present their views on this particular bill. We're going to give them that chance now. We have a sign-up sheet. And the way I like to do this, I like to have DEQ come forward first, and then we're going to give, depending on the list of length of the list, 3 to 4 minutes for each proponent and opponent to discuss the bill. We're going to try to go in a pro and con fashion, 2 up and 2 down. We have a sign-up sheet there. What do we have?
We're going to get another one out.
Oh, Lord.
Even 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
We have any more coming in?
I'm sure there's some people to vote on this.
Well, Paul talked yesterday on the bill that knocks him out pretty good. Okay. Paul, you understand that this committee you're only allowed one chance to address us per week.
Okay.
You had yours yesterday.
I won't make any notes.
We're going to hold, because of a time constraint here, we're going to hold everybody. You have any all sitting up?
Yeah, there's another sheet out there.
Has it got signatures on it?
Not yet.
Is anyone here who has not signed the original sheet going to sign the second sheet? Please do so. I have to have some idea of time management here.
Nice to do that at the front end, Senator.
Senator, yeah, I know what you're trying to get.
We sometimes think we end the hearings and then we find a whole second sheet of it.
I would like to start, as I said earlier, with the Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ. You want to step up and give your testimony first, and then we'll go through this. We're gonna have to hold everybody to about 3 minutes. I'm sorry, we've got that many people signed up, and I would be kind of strict about that. We've got about an hour and 15 minutes to do this in, and I want to give everyone a chance, if at all possible, to present. To also give written testimony to the committee, we're glad to receive that. Please identify yourself, and let's go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori Onan, representing Department of Environmental Quality, and with me is Dr. Mary Abrams, who's our laboratory administrator. I just have to say, as we start, this is my second week as water quality administrator. You've known me in a different role before. Holly Schroeder, who did talk with the Senate Land Use and Environment Committee on the mixing zone issue, has left Oregon for work and family in another state, so I'm very happy to be here talking about you with this today. I could spend a little bit of time talking about mixing zones in general, but unless you want me to, I think I'll talk a little bit about what we think about Senate Bill 532, because if we have 3 minutes, we won't be able to do both. I first want to thank the proponents of the bill for their concern about clean water and reducing toxic pollution. It's absolutely something that we all need to care about, is to make Oregon safer and healthier, and it is a priority for DEQ to protect people's health and the environment from toxic chemicals. There's a number of things that we constantly work on in this arena, and I will say that I won't go into a lot of details about what those are, but over time, our permit standards and permit limits and water quality standards have ratcheted down. They continue to become more and more stringent, particularly around persistent bioaccumulative toxics, which is what's addressed in Senate Bill 532. Our water quality standards for those toxics are set very low. The reason is that they're set to protect the most sensitive uses in the water, which is fish and bugs and critters that live in the water all the time. And those guys are obviously very sensitive to pollution. So when you say, well, how much is coming out of pipes or into the surface waters, oftentimes they're so small amounts that they're below laboratory detection limits. So this is what makes the issue very complicated. One of the things that makes it very complicated and difficult to kind of say, all right, how do we deal with these things? When this issue first came up this session, we looked into what was happening in other states. And EPA has adopted rules restricting mixing zones in one region, the Great Lakes. While these rules are on the books, the deadline for them to actually comply is 2010, so we don't know what's going to happen on the ground. But I found it very instructive to look at how long and how much monitoring data and other information was used by EPA and the other states to actually come up with what they came up with. It's a result of significant work over a period of about 30 years. They had significant monitoring to look at sources and severity of pollution issues. And just one statistics, EPA has given more than $80 million in grants, just grants alone, to different states and communities to work on the issues around the Great Lakes pollution. Now, Oregon is, of course, very different from the Great Lakes. The reason I bring this up is because I think government has a responsibility to make informed decisions about investments in pollution reduction based on solid information about the problem and what strategies have the best chance of solving the problem. Senate Bill 532 would require significant investment, not just by the state, but by local governments, businesses, and citizens. And the investment in this bill is focused on mixing zones. That's one part of the problem. But the way we are approaching water pollution, and we did talk about this a little bit in the budget committee hearing on our budget, is that we want to look at all pollution issues in a watershed and focus on holistic solutions that are sustainable for everybody involved. And we think that's the best way to ensure continued progress. So just in closing, and I'll certainly we can answer questions about the fiscal or anything else, we do believe Oregon needs more monitoring for toxics in water. Most of our water quality monitoring is supported by state general funds, and that has suffered reductions over the past 4 years. We can't do right now the level of toxic monitoring we'd like to do, and we'd certainly be very happy to work with the legislature and interested parties on a plan, okay, how do we increase toxic monitoring that will enhance the discussion around mixing zones and about toxics in general. So that's really all I had planned to say, and be happy to answer your questions.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Laurie. How much monitoring do you do now, and how far back does that data go?
Chair Bates and members of the committee, my name for the record is Mary Abrams. I'm the director of the DEQ laboratory. I am assuming, Senator Nelson, when you ask that question, that you're referring to our toxics monitoring and not just our monitoring in general, or would you rather hear the general as well?
Combination of both.
Okay.
How do you separate one from the other?
Well, most of our monitoring currently is involved with what we call conventional pollutants. They're the kind of things that you think of when you think of the bacteria problems or temperature issues that affect fish, some of our listed salmonid species, things like that. The toxics monitoring is quite different. It has a couple of complications involved with it. One is that there are a large number of toxics, what we would refer to as toxics. There is a dirty dozen that EPA put together, and some of those are important in Oregon and some of them aren't. And it was put together a considerable amount of time ago, and so there are now new and emerging toxics that we are concerned about in this state. The other issue that makes them toxics particularly difficult is that they don't tend to like water. And therefore, what we normally do is go out and grab a water sample and bring it back. Water is pretty a media that's relatively easy to handle. It's relatively easy to analyze. In the case of toxics, many of them are more soluble in oils, or they're more attracted to solids such as sediments. And so you don't find them in the water column except at extremely low levels, and that becomes both a difficult analytical chore, and also it's more difficult to correlate those very low water column concentrations with problems that might be happening with human health or with the environment. And so what you tend to need to do is to look at sediments and or fish tissue, and in both of those cases, those media are more complicated to analyze. They require extraction and extensive preparation of the sample before you can do the analysis. And then the final thing, of course, is many of these toxics that we really care about are bioaccumulative in nature. And that means that as an organism takes them up, instead of excreting them at a rate that would be appropriate for sort of normal, your normal calcium or vitamin C is a great example, they tend to hold on to them. And because of that, it's sometimes difficult to take a snapshot picture and correlate that effectively with a computer model with the kind of effects that you're seeing in both human health and the environment. So there's a number of smaller issues as well, but this is sort of the big issues of why toxics are difficult to deal with. And that's why we separate them out, and that's why we have not done that much toxics monitoring except in the case of really specific issues that we've been asked to look at. That's the long answer of why they're separated. Sorry about that. And then to answer your other question, we started monitoring about 1932, long before, obviously, we were even the Department of Environmental Quality. And we continue to monitor up until the present. You folks, when you considered our budget this year, looked at our water quality monitoring budget as part of that. But again, there's been very limited toxics except in targeted areas. We did start out doing some toxics sort of on a periodic basis around the state. By about the mid-1980s, we weren't able to sustain that with because of budget issues, and so we dropped that out, and then we did some metals. We tried to collect metals, which can be a toxics issue, periodically with our routine sampling. That suffered from budget cuts as well, and also an emphasis really in the late 90s that was directed towards the fish species, the listed fish species, because then you're more worried again about conventional pollutants, and so we directed a lot of effort in that direction, and that's still an ongoing effort. We did, as I said, there were a number of sort of geographic initiatives where people were really interested in particular toxics. One of them was the dioxin issue in the Willamette and Columbia back in the 80s and 90s. We worked with USGS to look at the Willamette, particularly as we were talking about the Portland Harbor and that lower Willamette area, and that was done also in the 1990s. So there have been a few, but most of them have been fairly limited in scope because of the costs associated with them.
Questions, but in the interest of
time. We could easily spend the next 2 days on this subject,
yeah,
okay? Senator Shields, do you have any questions?
Yeah.
The only thing I'd like to say is that we've had what I felt were fruitful, very short discussions on this topic. I'm personally convinced that we need a better monitoring program that's more holistic, regular in nature, and covers the entire state. And I'm not convinced that doing pesticides, checking here, metals there, bioaccumulates somewhere else is the proper approach to that. Having said this, we will hear this bill today and gather more information. I would rather see us take a much broader approach to this and one that's more scientifically based. I think there is potentially a problem out there, but we don't know it. And only by monitoring both sediment and fish and water are we ever going to find that out. We may be pleasantly surprised, or it may be a much clearer state than we think it is, or we may have problems, but we will not know until we actually have done some checking on this. This comes from someone who's been involved in this now for 6 months, so don't take that as gospel. But I've been a fisherman for 30 years, so I spend a lot of time in deep water, okay? Having said that, thank you very much for your testimony, and we will go to John Ledger. Whoops. And I guess we won't be going to Mr. John Ledger. God has spoken.
Very short, Mr. Chairman. When John gets up to speak, do the lights always go out?
I do have a handout. I was going to use a PowerPoint, but...
I will point out, John, that was caused by someone on the opposite side. Jury to disregard the lights going on.
Okay. I'm just going to scoot through these very quickly, skip many of them. You can look at them at your leisure. The first slide, imagine this PowerPoint. You know, so we have a pause while everything comes up here. And this, when you're talking about mixing zones, I don't think we'll spend much time on it because I don't think it's a fruitful way to go. We're really talking about two points of compliance, two standards, a discharge standard and an ambient standard, and where you measure them. When you drove down I-5 to come here today, you were in a long mixing zone. I-5 does not meet air quality standards most of the time. That's not where you measure ambient standards. You measure them like 150 feet off. You have discharge standards and emission standards. It's common. The second slide shows EPA has a big PBT program, lists some of the PBTs. Many of these are groups. That's this slide here. And many of these are groups, so it may look like one chemical, but like dioxin or lots of different kinds of dioxin. That's why it's expensive to test. Next slide here shows you which ones we're dealing with from the industrial side. Most PBTs are legacy items. They've been banned or they're no longer used. But they're still around in the environment in sediment, but they're not being discharged. The second page shows you some more that are either banned or discharged. You'll notice mercury is still being discharged, and also one we're still looking at is dioxin. So those two we're still dealing with. The next slide, which we'll just scoot through real quickly, mercury and the compounds. There's extensive controls on mercury emissions now, federal and state level. It's everywhere. But this is the most interesting one of all. This one shows you dioxin and what has happened with dioxin over the years. And what you do with dioxin, because there are different types, is they kind of equilibrate it all to the most toxic type. It's got equivalent toxicities. So you can compare overall toxicity of dioxin. And you can see in 1987, we had quite a bit of dioxin being emitted. It was probably upwards of, 20 pounds, 30 pounds nationally a year, most of it coming from incineration. And now, when you're looking at EPA projections, the biggest bulk is open burning of household waste. That's the white bar. And we're probably down to the equivalent of about 2 pounds a year nationwide. Mercury, which is the next slide, I took this clipped right off of what's called the EPA Toxic Release Inventory, TRI. And anybody of any size has to report, an industrial facility has to report to TRI their emissions of various compounds. So I just clipped it right off and pasted it in. And you'll see mercury, surface water discharges for the year 2002 was 4 pounds statewide for Oregon. 2003 was down to 0.4. I don't know what caused the drop. They go over to the other side, mercury compounds, 0.5 pounds, total reported discharge industrially in Oregon, down to 0.5 pounds. So it's been dropping. The next slide is dioxins and related compounds, which are different types of dioxins and furans. And you'll notice there in 2002, to discharges to surface waters was 24 grams statewide from industrial sources. That's about 0.5 pounds. We're now down, because of various very strict DEQ rules and very strict EPA rules, we're now down to about 15 ten-thousandths of a pound a year of dioxin being emitted from industrial sources. The next slide is another list of PBTs. It's just another list that EPA uses. You can look at that. Just again, this one with the rose-colored charts that just shows you what's being emitted and what percent of Oregon PBTs are coming from the source. So if you look at this chart that has the roses on it, the rose-colored bars, and you look at the near the bottom, like where it says lead, there's 23 pounds a year being discharged to surface waters from industrial facilities. That's about 0.003% of all the lead emitted in the state.
Time?
Okay, as I'm leaving, you got a chart here on mercury reductions, chart on teaspoons of dioxin emitted, and this is the best one that you really need to look at. Because I took the fiscal cost of this bill, about $4 million, and I divided the amount of dioxin that's emitted into it. So it comes out to be about $2.5 billion per pound of dioxin control. But take your time, look through this stuff. These are the first numbers and the only numbers you're probably going to see.
Thank you very much. I will call up Heidi. I'm amazing this one. Dallin?
Dallin. Senator, we had three people who were not on that list. We're going to kind of kick things off from our side.
Want to bring all three of them up at the same time?
Either way, that's fine.
Probably faster. We're going to do that.
We're going to try to get before you first.
this thing go.
Yeah, let's keep this thing going, so go ahead.
Good afternoon, Senator Bates and committee members. My name is Brent Foster. I'm here today on behalf of Columbia Riverkeeper and Willamette Riverkeeper to support Senate Bill 532A. And also want to point out, I guess as an initial point, this is not Senate Bill 555. This is not a bill that has a ban on toxic mixing zones. This is not a bill that even phases out toxic mixing zones. What this bill does is basically three things. And without getting into a three-minute dispute of what the previous testimony said, I can tell you that those facts are significantly different than we believe them to be, and they kind of grossly distort both what the meaning of that toxics reporting data means. I'm not going to go too much into depth on that, but first off,
let me make a comment about that real quickly. Is DEQ still here?
Yes.
I'd like to have you confirm numbers we see later on for me, would you please? We have to identify you. I'm sorry, we can't just say yes in the back of the audience.
My name is Mary Abrams.
Okay, whenever there's a debate over numbers, I would like to have that vetted by the Department of Environmental Quality, because I have no way of knowing what the truth is.
I can tell you with a high degree of certainty on my part, there's a lot more than 40 pounds of lead per year being discharged from industrial point sources. And
remember, he was talking. Okay, we'll let the DEQ settle.
Right,
okay.
No problem. But so quick, what does 532 do? First off, it directs DEQ to adopt a plan to substantially reduce the discharge of bioaccumulative toxins. Doesn't set a clear standard, doesn't say how much you have to go. It just says, as a policy matter, we're going to start to try to reduce these. It doesn't say throw economic considerations to the wind or spend $2.5 billion per pound of dioxin. It doesn't say anything alike. It just begins to give DEQ an emphasis to actually start to reduce bioaccumulative toxins. Why is that necessary? Senator Bates, you mentioned we don't have the information about whether there's a problem. In fact, there's a significant amount of information that there's a problem. The two most recent studies, one done by DEQ, by a group called EBS, found that through looking at fish toxicity in the Willamette River, that that the people consuming those fish could have an increased cancer risk by between 4 to 3,000%. That's not an environmentalist saying it. That was DEQ-sponsored study. Similar study done by EPA and CRITFIC on the Columbia River found that tribal members had a 50 times or about 5,000% increased risk of cancer because of the toxics that were present in the fish. Some of those toxics are legacy toxics. I don't want to try to mislead it. Some of those toxics, like arsenic, like mercury, and other heavy metals like lead continue to be discharged into toxic mixing zones. The other thing 532 would do was increase monitoring. Right now, DEQ will allow a discharger to discharge, say, something like lead or arsenic at concentrations that exceed state standards, exceed the water quality criteria for what's toxic, and not even require monitoring of that toxic. DEQ stands up here and says we don't have enough data. I totally agree. But every day they issue new permits that let people dump toxic pollutants at toxic concentrations, and despite our lengthy diatribes on why they should require monitoring, they don't. Okay, and that is not difficult monitoring to do. There's not, when it's coming out of the pipe, it's $30 to take a sample and send it off and get it tested for a single metal, which is the most common thing that we see violating the toxicity standards. That's an easy thing that DEQ could do. It doesn't even take legislation, but this legislation does make it a requirement. Second, fish toxicity monitoring. We know of no fish toxicity monitoring that DEQ has done around toxic mixing zones. If we're going to use these widespread, and toxic mixing zones we use, it's not just a buzzword, but that is the way that we see that industry, municipalities, everybody is allowed to discharge at above the toxic toxic threshold. It is not the only place putting pollutants into the river by any means, but it is a place and an easy place we could measure and start to look at what the effects of these would be. Finally, 532, it doesn't ban toxic mixing zones. It just says you got to try to substantially reduce toxics. It says you got to monitor more, and then it says you have to notify the public about where these toxic mixing zones are. If there are toxic mixing zones where multiple toxics are being discharged at concentrations in excess of what DEQ has set as the criteria, and people are fishing in them, there is a very good chance that those fish, if they're spending any kind of substantial portion of their time in that mixing zone, have increased concentrations of those toxic in them. And that's, you know, it's not a question about whether or not toxics in fish are a problem. We have two very credible studies that neither AOI or anyone else disputes. Showing that there are toxics ending up in fish, and those fish end up on people's dinner tables, and this bill would at least start to reverse that trend. Added to the fact that Willamette River and Columbia River are both listed as water quality limited for a number of toxics, including mercury, including lead, arsenic, etc. I'm sorry, not lead, but arsenic, mercury, and other toxics, which continue to be discharged into toxic mixing zones. Again, without monitoring, and again, without no assessment. A recent settlement I just had with Georgia Pacific and DEQ, DEQ acknowledged that in Georgia Pacific's mixing zone, which discharged lead, chlorine, aluminum, and other compounds, they did no analysis of the toxic effects as a part of the toxic mixing zone study before they issued that permit. This is one of the largest mixing zones in the state. I give GP credit and DEQ credit for agreeing to a plan that we think will substantially reduce the toxics that are coming out, but it was an example. If they agree and they didn't do it in one of the biggest toxic mixing zones in Oregon, then we think that only makes it all the clearer that they're certainly not doing it in a lot of the smaller ones. And that's what we see. I review these permits all the time. So I will wrap up there and pass it on to Travis Williams, but I thank you for your time and for considering this bill.
Thank you.
Chair Bates and committee members, my name is Travis Williams, and I'm Riverkeeper and Executive Director for Willamette Riverkeeper. Our organization works on habitat and water quality issues throughout the Willamette Basin. I think one thing I want to underscore today is the notion of letting people know what is happening along the river. You know, we have a lot of families and a lot of individuals that go throughout the year, and especially in the spring and summer, to travel the Willamette, to recreate on it, to kayak, to canoe, to swim and fish. And you can go from Eugene all the way down to the mile number one on the Willamette and really not know, other than a couple of very obvious sites, where a mixing zone might be or a major industrial municipal discharge. In our view, it is not much to ask to, you know, put buoys or to sign these areas where mixing zones are actually occurring. Now, we've heard a bit from folks that they say, well, you know, that's putting some kind of an economic hardship on us to put a buoy in the middle of the river or to put a sign. I have to disagree with that wholeheartedly. You know, you can go down to Fisherman's Marine and buy a big orange buoy for about $49, get yourself $40 worth of cable or rope and some type of pretty basic anchor to the bottom of the river, and there you have your buoy. It's not rocket science. There's many places in the Columbia system and the Willamette system where this is done today for navigational purposes and for other safety hazards. So, again, the notion of showing people where these discharges are, I think, is pretty important. You know, you can imagine a mom or a dad traveling the river in a canoe or kayak and saying, hey, let's pull over here to go fishing. You know, if you knew that was a mixing zone with elevated levels of various toxics in it, possibly, I would stand a guess that most people wouldn't want to fish there. So, you know, as to the fish testing, just underscoring what Brent said, you know, this is basic stuff. I mean, in the state of Oregon, we ought to be able to figure out how to set up a testing program once a year, twice a year, that goes statewide, that looks at a basic list of toxic contaminants in fish tissue. Again, this is something that is done each and every day in various parts of the state for one purpose or another, typically related to a known problem with sediment contamination. You can look at all the work and all the folks that are employed down in Portland Harbor doing work for a very good reason to figure out what is in fish tissue. Well, we can justify a similar effort throughout the state if for no other reason to simply let people know that either A, hey, the fish are clean here, or B, we have an issue. So, again, I think it's a basic right-to-know issue there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We gave the panel 12 minutes. The last guy got shorted here. You have 2 minutes. Okay.
No problem. I can do that. In fact, I can do it in 1 minute.
Chair Bates, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. We are a cold water conservation group with approximately 150,000 members nationwide and 3,400 here in the state of Oregon. And we support SB 532. We do consider it a compromise, but we're particularly supportive of it for the fish monitoring program. I speak not only as a conservationist, but of a fisherman in the state for 40 years, since I was five. And I'm concerned that we don't have a consistent monitoring program for toxicity in fish. And a lot of people, there are approximately 700,000 licenses sold, fishing license sold in the state of Oregon. A lot of people fish. We have kids that don't get licenses to fish, and it's sad to me that in this state we don't have some sort of consistent monitoring program for the toxicity in fish. So I urge, it's not the best, but I urge that SB 532 be passed out of this committee and down to the Senate floor. And as a sixth generation Oregonian, I've followed in history that when my ancestors came to the little community of Mountaindale up in the Tualatin Basin, it was a system full of steelhead and cutthroat and wild clean waters, and it's changed a lot in the last 160 years. But I'd like to think that this bill could have a lot to do with restoring some of the quality of the water and allow us to see the toxicity in fish and be a boon to fishermen and all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Paul Cosgrove.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, Paul Cosgrove representing the American Forest and Paper Association. I'm also appearing today on behalf of Catherine Vanetta, who is at the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association annual meeting. You have my written testimony. I won't go through that. I'd just like to make two or three quick points. The pulp and paper industry, which is an important part of Oregon's economy, agrees with the statements of DEQ that we have tough standards here in Oregon, and they're getting tougher, and they should be getting tougher. We also agree that the way to look at these problems of water quality is a holistic manner, and watershed-wide solutions are the ways to review and tackle important water quality issues. The industry has actively participated for years in working with DEQ on trying to do that holistic and basin-wide kind of approach, and we continue to do that and support that as the effort. We do not support Senate Bill 532. This is a narrow look at one small piece of the pie, and just to give you an example of that, not to say that mercury coming from all sources isn't a problem, but as I think Senator Bates, when I went earlier in the session talked to you, I provided some charts that I didn't think to bring today about the sources of mercury in the Willamette Basin, something that DEQ is actively working on, and actively working on how to control and reduce the sources of mercury in the Willamette Basin. Both the municipal sewage treatment plant portion of that source of mercury and the industrial, both of them are in the 1% or so range. So clearly, if we think mercury is a problem, and we do, we need to tackle the other 98% and maybe even tackle that first. This bill focuses on mixing zones. What we believe we ought to be focusing on is the river and the watershed as a whole. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Shields.
Yeah, Paul. We've talked about this before, and I understand what you're saying. But, you know, just to pick one piece, what's the matter with putting a buoy in the river? I mean, it's a simple thing. It could raise public awareness. I don't understand the problem with that. I mean, sure, we need to keep doing all the other things, but why not do that one little piece?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, I think the easiest way to respond to that is, in essence, putting a buoy on a mixing zone where microscopic amounts of, say, mercury are being discharged is, at bottom, misleading to the public. to assume that that's where the problem is, not upstream from there where runoff from our mercury-rich soil is happening at a far greater rate. It takes attention away from looking at what the real problem is and focuses on a highly politicized, in our view, microcosm of where the problem is. So I think, in fact, an argument could be made that that misleads the public rather than informs the public about what our water quality problems are and how they need to be addressed.
Hello? Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much. I'll probably say the name wrong again. I apologize. Heidi?
Dolan.
Dolan. Okay.
It could be Dolan as well.
Thank you. Identify yourself, please.
Good afternoon, Senator Bates and committee members. My name is Heidi Dolan, and I am a mother of two, and I work for Oregon City School District. And I suppose you could say I'm here representing the children of Oregon. And I'm also a member of the public. I do not agree with the fact that it would be misleading for me to know where toxic mixing zones are. I most certainly understand that pollution in the Willamette comes from a variety of sources. I live in Oregon City, and I have for 23 years, and our community is located at Willamette Falls. And I have spent many an hour a day along the river, taking my children there, taking them to see the falls. I was stunned to find out that there are 7 toxic mixing zones in the Willamette Falls area, and as my children and I stood on the banks of Willamette and felt the spray of the water on our faces, that it contained toxic chemicals. I feel that I should have a right to know that so that I can make an informed decision about whether I'm going to take my children there or not. Oregon City has a variety of public marinas. We have public docks. We have parks along there that are heavily used. Children swim in the Willamette. There is the hog line there for it's a prime fishing spot. We have Eel Fest. There's a resident eel population at the base of the falls that people go fish for and eat. This all happens within a half-mile radius of 7 toxic mixing zones on the Willamette River. I think we have a right to know that. I was recently asked to submit information for Oregon City School District about how many children live within a 4-mile radius of Willamette Falls. When I asked about why they needed this information, I was told that they are doing a Superfund assessment of the Willamette Falls site. 12,000 children live and go to school within a 4-mile radius of Willamette Falls. These are kids that swim in the river. These are kids that eat fish that come out of the river. And I think that we need to go and look at what is the cost for these kids and what is the effect on public health by having toxic mixing zones. In Oregon City right now, we are looking at why has our population that qualify for special services increased? We've gone from 13% to 16.6% in the last 3 years, with the leading cause being autism about why children qualify for these services. It's a known fact that there is a tie-in with heavy metals and neurological disorders such as attention deficit disorder and autism. I don't know where this is coming from, but on the other hand, we have to be aware of what we're doing to our river and the effect on public health. I believe that we as Oregonians take great pride in our state, and we want to be known for being on the forefront for environmental protection and having a clean environment. We need to do this not only for ourselves, but we need to do this for future generations as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Willie Tiffany.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and we are opposed to Senate Bill 532. Again, I'd like to concur with Ms. Onan's testimony from DEQ and your premise, Mr. Chair, that we really do need to look at these issues on a watershed basis. I can assure you that city officials are committed to providing for long-term environmental needs and benefits in Oregon. Our citizens demand it. They're the same constituents that you have, and you know that. So we try to be as environmentally conscious as possible. In fact, municipalities in Oregon are spending billions of dollars towards those ends. We don't disagree with necessarily the premise of 532. Again, we think that in terms of watershed monitoring, in terms of the toxics issue in general, we do need to have some sort of basin-wide or basin-to-basin approach on where these toxins are coming from and what the exact quality of water in those basins are. We just believe that this bill is the wrong way to go about it. I could go section by section, but I'll for time purposes, not do that. I just do want to say for the record, we heard an earlier testimony that municipalities in Oregon are not exceeding state or federal standards in terms of their discharges. And I guess maybe the last point, and in terms of the signage, we do believe that that is the buoy system is a costly way to go about it. We are not opposed to public information as public entities. All of our information is public, and we'd be willing to work with folks on that issue. And I just bring to light that when we're talking about these issues, municipalities, a municipal treatment plant doesn't produce anything. It receives and treats effluent from all of us, from all of our industries, from all of our residents. And so really when we look at these issues, we look at source prevention, we look at what are the best ways to get at these toxic approaches, not just at the narrow specific end of pipe. How do you treat something or detect something at end of pipe? How do you prevent it from getting in the system? And I think if we did do some statewide monitoring on toxics issue and specifically, that would help us get at some of those solutions. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. Any questions?
Just a quick one. Willie, I appreciate the fact that municipalities don't produce any toxins. They're being charged with trying to get rid of the ones that we all create together. My question would be, you know, I'm not saying there's any love canals anywhere around, okay? But what if you had a site that's never been monitored and really did turn up to be producing an unacceptable amount of some toxin? We don't know that. And we have some of the kids that the school teacher was just referring to that were in the river for whatever reason, and we don't find out until later because we didn't have any information beforehand. Wouldn't we regret the damage done to a few children when we didn't have the information that we could have had? A buoy, I don't understand this reluctance to even allow a buoy to be in place. You know, I guess I operate from a precautionary principle. If it might not be the be-all, end-all, but if it's some sort of precaution, even if it's not needed, wouldn't you rather err on the side of caution?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, I would say that in most of these river systems that the most information we do have are from mixing zones. We are required on a monthly basis to report all the constituents that are discharged and at what levels and to assure that we're meeting compliance standards. So we do have a lot of good information about those areas. I do agree with Mr. Cosgrove. The mere fact of labeling something toxic just because it happens to be in that area without any respect to the water quality in general, when we know that mixing zones have to be calculated such that the acute effects on bioorganisms and human life have to be at such a level as to protect those beneficial uses. In terms of a specific buoy or not, Senator Shields, I don't know if that's the way to do it or not, but I can tell you that it's not $49. I can tell you that in the Willamette in particular, CFS flows will change thousands of CFS between storm events and between water event summer and winter. We have coastal dischargers who discharge 2 miles out in the Pacific Ocean. That presents quite a problem. We have all sorts of navigation, recreation, other uses that could create problems. Maybe it is the best way to go, Senator Shields. I'm not sure. We think it does create a problem. We think there's better ways to go about it, and we're not afraid of public disclosure because we're required to do that anyway. So we're willing to work with you and anyone else on that issue.
Any questions? One quick question for me, and just make it fast. You said you test the water every on a monthly basis. Do you test the sediment or fish around toxic mixing zones or mixing zones at all?
Mr. Chair, as not a water treatment plant operator, I can't answer that question specifically. I think some municipalities do. I'm not sure in relationship to their specific water quality MPDES permit requirements.
Thank you. Next up would be Rob Kirshner, and if you don't mind, I'm going to ask Nancy Hatch to come up with him. Are they here? Kirshner and Hatch. Hayes first.
My name is Nancy Hatch. I want to thank you for giving me and others the opportunity to speak to you today. I come here as somebody who's concerned about our environment in general, as an active member of Osberg and the Sierra Club, but mostly as an Oregonian who are concerned about the wellness of our environment for other Oregonians. I spent some time this spring with the Sierra Club going to door-to-door in both Oregon City and West Lynn talking to people in those communities about toxic mixing zones. And a lot of them I found kind of heard rumors or get a sense that there is ongoing chemicals being put into the river around them, but most people didn't know the details about it, didn't really understand that there's a permitting that's required, that it's a part of a DEQ process, the exact companies that are the ones that get the permits to do it. And I found that people were extremely concerned when they found out that companies are legally allowed to put into the river toxic chemicals at toxic rates that extend or that go beyond the Clean Water Standards Act. And people were extremely frustrated, or I got the sense of being frustrated for a long time because they sort of knew something was going on but didn't really understand what can be done about it. And I found a lot of people I talked to were extremely appreciative of the work that the Sierra Club and other environmental organizations have done to try to empower people to understand what's going on and to have a bill like this that at least starts to address the problem. It's one of those things that seems to be on people's mind, but until a bill like this comes along, they haven't had an opportunity to really do something about it. And, you know, the bill, I think, makes a lot of common sense. The greatest problem to humans that we can document from having chemicals in the water that bioaccumulate is humans consuming the fish that they bioaccumulate in. And, you know, it's common sense that the higher up on the food pyramid or the food chain that a fish is or an aquatic animal is, the more chemicals it's going to bioaccumulated, the longer it exists within an area of a body of water that has toxic chemicals, the more chemicals it will accumulate. But having that common sense and being able to make the link that it's actually there in these certain fish in these certain part of the river isn't the same thing. And so having this bill will enable us to know, answer some of those questions that have been common sense. And just to quickly mention, certainly I understand that the watershed issue of chemicals coming from multiple places is a big issue, but we know definitively that the point sources coming in from the industries that get these permits to have toxic mixing zones are a significant source of these chemicals. And if indeed they already are doing monthly testing, then this bill is simply asking them to continue that. It's not asking them to do something in addition to what they've already done. It's just keeping up, providing the same data and to the public this time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Bates, committee members. My name is Rob Kirshner. I come here today as a fourth-generation Northwest fly fisherman, and I'm here to support 532. Several years ago, I had to make a decision as to where I was going to attend law school, and as well as my friends at the law school who have become great fishing buddies of mine. And every morning now for the past year, we've gone out before class to fish on the Willamette and the Clackamas. And just recently, I've become aware that possibly our health may be in danger because companies are being allowed to pollute at water quality levels that greatly exceed what is known to be healthy for human consumption. And I wish I knew how many steelhead that we've taken home to throw on the barbecue and what effect that has had on my health and on their health, but apparently we don't know. This bill just seems absolutely like a no-brainer to someone like myself. Something as simple as putting buoys out to allow the public to know where it may not be safe to catch fish and to consume those fish. It just seems ridiculous why that's not being done already. And I think the public is under the assumption that this kind of thing happens already anyways. Just these simple things that can be done to protect the public's health is just a no-brainer. And as elected officials, I'm sure that you all know that, I mean, you're here to represent, you know, your constituents and your communities. And I don't see anything more basic than protecting the health of the people who live in your districts. And to know that these people could go out on any Saturday afternoon with their child to go and enjoy a morning of fishing with their son and to take a fish home and not knowing whether that's going to be dangerous for their health is just ridiculous. And I think that it's the most basic responsibility to make sure that you're protecting the health of the public. And that Senate 532 is such a compromise, it just seems this is the least that can be done to protect people like myself and others who have chosen to stay in Oregon because of the quality of the environment and the recreation that's available.
Thank you. I tell you, as a fellow fly fisherman of 50 years, I'm appalled that you killed Tacoma Steelhead.
It's a hatchery steelhead.
Well, I'll allow that, okay? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have nobody else in the opposition to the bill, so the rest of the testimony will be in favor of the bill. I want people to know I'm not cutting anybody out of this. Thank you very much for your testimony, both of you. Les Helgeson and Karen Schaefer. We're just barely squeaking through here. It's going to be close. We're doing it.
Thank you, Chair Bates, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Les Helgeson. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. And we support the bill. I should leave it at that, but there are certain elements we particularly are fond of, and I think the direction to adopt and periodically revise a water quality plan makes total sense. I'd like to draw a parallel with a bill that was passed out of that other committee you referred to earlier, House Bill 2577, which did a similar thing with noxious weeds in the state of Oregon. So this is a good thing. It's long overdue. Sure, we can talk about the big picture, but biotoxics are one part of that big picture, and sometimes you need to deal with the pieces as well as the overall big picture. And if I'm not misreading this bill, this is stating that the buoys need to be placed only in those instances where a discharger has been shown to be violating water quality standards. Now, we'll assume that that's the minority of the industry and municipalities, so this should not be a big deal. It's just letting the public know that this is a particular problem area. So I do have one concern about the testing of fish only in mixing zones. I think there are better organisms that could be tested, specifically the macroinvertebrates that reside within there. The fish move around so much, we feel that fish should be tested, and those that have been tested throughout the Willamette, I would never eat one of those fish, even a hatchery fish. No way. So there's a little bit of work to be done there. I'm not opposing that section of the bill, but I think if you have a work session, there are other... I believe testing macroinvertebrates could be considerably cheaper than testing fish tissue. Again, DEQ could maybe correct me or support me on that statement. My one other concern is the potential for, where's the funding coming for this? And not to beat a dead horse, but we have consistently been opposing the use of Measure 66 to backfill these agencies for this sort of thing. And again, referring to House Bill 2577, quote,
The department and the board shall initiate and actively pursue efforts to secure the maximum, or I think it was changed to optimum, available federal and private funding for noxious weed control and so forth. Why can't we insert similar language in this bill and pass it without having any fiscal? I don't believe that 25-7 was referred to this committee. It's passed unanimously by both chambers. It's an idea to consider.
Thank you. Thank
you very much.
Hi, my name is Karen Schaefer, and I am a teacher in Portland, and I'm also a dragon boater and also a fly fisherman. I spend a lot of time in the Willamette River as a dragon boater. I have just three major points I want to make. A lot of them have, it's funny, I don't even know who you are, but we have a lot of the same points. First, I want to talk about the standards. Oregon has very stringent water quality standards. That's been brought several times. The whole point of the mixing zone is that in that zone, the standards are, they go above the standards. They're exceeded in those zones. So despite the stringent standards, the mixing zone is a place where you go above those standards. Also, there's a lot of talk about mercury and dioxins. Mercury and dioxins are pretty much two most well-known of these toxins in the mixing zone. Someone from the DEQ was talking about the Dirty Dozen. There are so many others. You can't just look at the mercury and the dioxin data and make a blanket statement about that. I think that's something that definitely needs to be taken into consideration. And also, the standards are based, if they're based on individual organisms, safety, we're not taking into effect bioaccumulation. So I think that that's something, it's a new topic that I think really needs to be thought about, just the bioaccumulation, especially in sediments and fish, like we talked about. Second of all, lots of people are coming up and talking about having a holistic approach. And everybody knows that a holistic approach for the whole watershed is really important. But we need to take steps towards this holistic approach. Having some big, great idea doesn't get you anywhere unless you start somewhere. And I think this bill is somewhere to start. I wanted to put in some of my experience from teaching. I just did a Willamette River unit with my sixth graders, and they had to do this timeline where they started at 1850 and went through what was with the Willamette River, and at the end gave them a little future box with a question mark, and they got to do whatever they wanted in this box. And let me tell you, you've never seen scarier organisms than they drew in these boxes: browner water, green gook, all this stuff. And I asked them, I said, this is the future, this is your guys' future, you can make a difference. And I said, why did you draw this? They said, nobody cares. Nobody cares about us or our environment. And I think that's a message that you need to know, that kids are thinking, and that's something that needs to be done. Now, in my own personal experience, as far as buoys go, I splash and get splashed with Willamette River water 4 days a week when I'm dragon boating, and I can't imagine how many other people are. I would really like to know where mixing zones are, so I'm not splashing myself with that water. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Always nice to hear from one of our teachers. Thank you. Thank you for what you do. Next is Elisa, and I hope I don't ruin this name also, Lunis, Looney, and Martin Taylor. Martin, did you still want to... Martin's not here. Rhett Lawrence? Please, go ahead and give your testimony.
Great. Hi, Chairman Gates and committee members. Can you hear me? I'm Elisa Looney, and I live in Portland, Oregon. I am a mother. My son's here. He's 13. And when I got this information on email, I said, I have to go because I really, really care about the rivers. And I've fished all my life. I was raised in Idaho. And my river, Spokane River, is now a Superfund site. And so I know in the tests I've had with lots of heavy metals in my system is from living and fishing and swimming in that river. And I get very passionate about this subject because, you know, just living in the Northwest most of my life and fishing and loving it and knowing that all life is dependent on water, fresh, clean water, I wouldn't pass up a chance to just say that in public and that I care. And this bill is just a tiny little start, in my opinion. I don't think any toxins should be released in the rivers at all. And mixing zones are, like, to me, the scariest thing. I think kids should know where they are, and adults and fishermen, and also they should be eliminated eventually. There's got to be other ways to filter that out and pre-pouring it in the river. One other thing I wanted to say was I'm also a graphic artist, so and a fine artist, and I did a piece last year on celebrating the salmon and the connection to a river and the spiritual connection we all have, also the physical connection, and it's just so important that we all get that. It's not like we are just humans living here off of the land. Everything lives here, and we're all connected. We're not just talking about humans here. And I would give up using papers that come from a company that, you know, in my graphic career that pollutes the water. I would change my career if I have to. I mean, I think we should really, really consider these things. It's really important. So,
thank you very much. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Bates, members of the committee. My name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm an environmental advocate with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I've submitted written testimony. I won't go through that. I just wanted to address a couple of points that have already been made, and a lot of the points I would have made have already been made by others. So just wanted to address, someone earlier said that this bill represents a narrow look at toxics, and I think I agree with that. There are any number of problems with the Willamette River and with the water bodies of the state, and, you know, as has been said by others already, you know, this is a start. This is some place where we can make that first step. And, you know, again, we have all kinds of problems related to non-point, you know, fertilizer runoff and what runs out off our driveways, all that. We understood that those are problems that need to be addressed. But, you know, again, this is the part we know how to fix, you know, because of the water quality standards that are supposed to be governing what point source discharges are being allowed to discharge into our rivers. I mean, these, you know, we have set up these standards for a reason, and that, you know, so this is a way for us to take a positive step in addressing at least that part of the issue. You know, for instance, discharging mercury from any point source into a river, the Willamette River, that we already know is compromised for mercury, and allowing those mercury discharges to, you know, be in excess of, you know, 7 or 8 times above the state water quality standards for mercury. I mean, there is something fundamentally misguided about that to me. And one other point that was made earlier, I forget who said it or what the exact quote was about the amount of lead being discharged in the state. I know Brent Foster had a PowerPoint that he had wanted to present today and was not able to, but the information we have gathered from one Georgia-Pacific facility on the Columbia River, I believe, they're discharging 40 pounds of lead from that one outfall alone, from one outfall alone at just that one plant. And we'd be happy to get that information to you separately to get that actual data to you. So again, just to summarize, I do think Senate Bill 532 as it exists now is compromised way down from where we started with Senate Bill 535. You know, this is a good step in the right direction. If we want to be getting our waterways in the state cleaned up, we need to, you know, take a step at reducing the discharge of, you know, persistent bioaccumulative toxins into our rivers. And so this bill will allow us to start gathering that data, doing the monitoring, to find out what, you know, what kind of problem we've got, and, you know, give us that the step to get there to solve the problem. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you both for your testimony. Michael Mason and Jessica Hamilton will be the last two up now, I believe. If any might have missed. He missed his chance. Come on up. We'll let you wrap up, Martin, okay? Michael Mason and Jessica Hamilton.
All right, sorry. My name is Jessica Hamilton, and I am the Legislative Affairs Director for the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, and I'm speaking on behalf of a broader coalition. It's called the Oregon Conservation Network, and that's a group of approximately 80 different organizations across the state that are working to protect our quality of life here in Oregon. And maybe I can take off my professional hat for a second and put on a personal hat, and I know my colleagues are tired of me using this story, but I competed on a water ski team in college, and I have taken that passion with me to Oregon. You can tell I have a slight accent. I've been in Oregon for about 10 years, and it is still my passion to go up and down the Willamette River on a ski and frequently fall into that river. And it is, as soon as I started working on this bill, I have not gone water skiing, and I think it's largely because I'm concerned about where I might fall. This is actually a priority issue for the coalition. The Oregon Conservation Network came up with a list of proactive environmental bills that they wanted to see move forward this session, and the toxic mixing zone issue is one of our absolute most important issues that we are working on right now. And, of course, we are concerned that the bill 532 is not as strong as the first one that we had discussed earlier on in the session, but we do think this is an important first step. So we do encourage you all to support SB 532. And we hope you'll have a work session and move it out next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bates and members of the subcommittee. My name is Michael Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation. I also note that the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation has presented written testimony. I'm not going to present written testimony, but I am going to leave you with a rather large poster that shows summarizes the results of a joint EPA Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission study of toxics in fish in the Columbia Basin. And we would join with the Umatillas in supporting the bill primarily because this is a major human health issue for the tribes. And they point out that their consumption of fish is 3 to 20 times what the perceived Oregon average is. I happen to think the Oregon average is a little low that DEQ uses. But certainly the Warm Springs eat just as much fish as their upriver brothers and sisters. And we're particularly concerned that there be funding for the kind of monitoring and testing that should happen. I think we'd agree with your comment, Chair, that the you don't want to just approach this in a narrow way. I mean, the pollutants, some of them are, I mean, we talk about persistence. Some of them have been in the system for 40 or 50 years. They're in the river. This is not all about what's going into the river now. But we are concerned, you know, very concerned that there be the testing. The children especially, that people are very concerned about with the amount of fish consumption. I can tell you that many of these kids are eating fish, especially salmon, at every meal. And one of the startling things is even to see the amount of toxics that are in the salmon. I don't know if it's important to open this thing up, but what the heck, I will, since time hasn't been called. But here. And thank you, Senator. But this shows by different types of fish, the amount of either, to some extent this is pesticides, but many other chemicals as well that are in the fish. One of the startling facts here is the fact that a lot of, not pesticides, but other toxins are found in lamprey or eels. And eels, as I've mentioned to other subcommittees, before there was Viagra, there were eels. And the eels are still very, very effective and very popular with the elders. So,
maybe more information than I need right now, but I appreciate that.
And you don't go blind either. So
yeah.
Okay.
If I could ask one question.
Oh, certainly. Sorry.
Have any of the tribes done any testing on members of the tribe to see if they have toxic levels within them? Especially the kids?
Mr. Chair, they have done some testing, and we can get you that that information or those reports.
What has been your sense of those reports as far as lead, mercury, heavy metals, biocumulus? Do you have any sense about those?
I just know that the testing's been done and that people were alarmed by the results, but I don't know specifics, so I'd have to get you that information.
Please do.
It's been a couple years since I've been in a meeting about it.
I would really like to see that if I could.
Okay.
Thank you. Any questions about it?
Just a question, a quick one. You know, and maybe it's not to these witnesses particularly, but to everybody, it seems that we've been describing this thing as either or, and I'm beginning to raise the question of both and maybe it's more a question to Lori back there in the back. We say either, I mean, people say, some are saying, do this bill, and others are saying it's too narrow, and they're suggesting we should do a more comprehensive thing. And why is it that we don't think in terms of, yeah, sure, we got to do this big survey, we need to know what's going on all over Oregon, all the sources, but what's the matter with this kind of both-and approach? I mean, a buoy in a toxic mixing zone, for instance, while we're doing the broader picture. It's a broad question. I'd like an answer to that sometime, someplace.
I think that's a question we have to answer amongst ourselves here. I'm not sure it's up to the audience.
Yeah,
so.
I agree.
But it's a good question, and when we'll talk about it. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I appreciate everybody who came today. We tried to listen carefully. And we know that in the past you've not had a chance to be heard. I've been working on this issue now for about 3 months, it seems longer. But I've learned a lot, and we'll continue to listen. We will take this to leadership and discuss it further also. Martin, did you want to have a chance to speak? And then I should also ask, is anybody else in the audience who has not signed up but who want to speak for a moment? Martin, it's yours, and you're the last one.
Chair Bates, members of the committee.
Come up, sir. Was there a hand? I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand. Would you like to come up, please, sir? Were you signed up? Did I miss you by any chance?
No, I was not.
Okay, good.
I'll just start, because I know you're on a time crunch.
Yes, Martin.
For the record, my name's Martin Taylor. I'm here today representing the Sierra Club. The most important reason for me to charge up here is to thank you personally for all of your work on this issue and to thank this committee for taking the time to have a public hearing. I realize that there was quite a bit of process concern that happened earlier, and I think it's everyone's intention to have a full debate on this. This whole issue is an educational process, and I have to say, it's not just you as senators and the public who are being educated on the right to know about the toxins we put in the water. It's been me as well. I've learned a ton this session. I've learned a lot from this public hearing. And I think that one of the values of this debate is that we're moving from the positions of denial and paranoia to something in the middle where we are reaching not conclusions based on we don't want to know what's going on and not conclusions that the sky is falling, but conclusions around finding a middle ground. And that's really what this bill attempts to do. It attempts to give you enough information that you can isolate the specific spots in the state where we may have a problem. And the odds are pretty good that if you did the testing in Senate Bill 532, you'd find some spots where people are exposed to toxic levels of chemicals that would be harmful to them. If we did that, that would be a service to the public. My only other thought on this is that this might be a right-to-know bill for the public around buoys, but for you as lawmakers, I would think that this is a responsibility-to-know bill. The difference between a toxic mixing zone and runoff or air pollution is that you permit toxic mixing zones with the state. You're culpable for the harm that occurs when you give a permit for discharge of a toxin over 30 years and it accumulates, and then people have a health consequence as a result. If there are no health consequences, there's no responsibility. But the correct answer is not we don't want to know if there's a harm. The correct answer is to make sure there isn't one. And you can't really stop acid rain or runoff from the roads or natural occurring mercury. You can do a lot to improve the river quality, but you can't stop all those things. You could stop in a situation. If you did testing and you found one of 25 sites was actually hurting people, you could stop that. That would be what I think is the responsibility to know that comes with this bill and why this is different than 555 or others. It takes a very surgical approach to a complicated problem.
Thank you, Mark. Yes, sir.
For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the lobbyist for Association of Pulp and Paper Workers, Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and I'm here in representing my organization in opposition to this. We not only think, but we know this is very narrow when, you know, there has been analyzation of all things. My problem with this is knowing what happened to the people of the wood industry, and now everything is locked up in the courts. I would rather see a logical process go and be meticulous in its purpose rather than point at one individual entity or a few. You know, the fish do go all over the river, and I'd like to add that I grew up in Chicago and I did a lot of perch fishing, and I ate a lot of them perch, you know, all my life. And then you know what happened with the salmon. They had to tell people how to cut certain areas out you couldn't eat because of the pollution. So I'm very sensitive to that too, and I think we all are. But I believe we all came in here in our vehicles, and we're polluting the air. And if you look at Portland on any given rainy day, you know, there's a problem with the sewage there. I'm asking on behalf of our membership that a broad-based look at this issue be done. I don't want to see what happens to the steel workers, which I worked as for 25 years, and I don't want to see what happened to the wood people happen to us. It would adversely affect our membership's numbers. And as we know in Oregon, we need the jobs we have. But it isn't just the job issue either. We have families, you know. We want to have clean rivers as well. And we think the standards meet it right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other testimony? Hearing none. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 532. Thank you very much for your time.